Today on Maine Calling, Do Protests Matter? An encore presentation. Our right to gather together and make some noise about issues we care about is embedded in the First Amendment. From the Boston Tea Party to the Civil Rights Movement to the recent No Kings protests, Americans have taken to the streets to demonstrate for their beliefs. But how effective are protests in changing minds or changing laws? And how do we even measure that? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we listen back to our earlier conversation about the history of protests in our country, when they've been effective, and how to judge if a protest achieves its goal. And we'll look at the spectrum of civil disobedience and when that has made a difference. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. When people take to the streets wielding signs and shouting slogans on behalf of a cause, does it make a difference? Well, today we're going to explore a little bit of the history of protests in the U.S. and their impact today. My guest for the hour, Daryl West, who is a senior fellow and chair of governmental studies at the Brookings Institute, and Mark Brewer, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine. And Daryl, I apologize. I think I called it the Brookings Institute. It's the Brookings Institution, correct?
That is correct, but either identification is fine. So thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, I'll start with you. You know, it feels like we're in a time of extreme political polarization in America and that there are more protests than ever before. Are there? I mean, I suspect a lot of people who protested in the 60s would say, well, don't say that. What do you say?
Well, I came of political age in the 1960s, and certainly when you think about the Vietnam War movement, the environmental movement, the women's liberation movement, like the 60s and early 70s were definitely a period of great activism, a lot of people demonstrating, a lot of rallies, a lot of protests. I'm not sure the level that we see today is comparable to what I recall from that earlier time period, but it's a different era in the sense that here, because of social media, protests can be either in physical form of people going out on the streets and protesting and rallying, or people protesting online. And certainly, I think everybody's social media posts are filled with strong feelings on either side of the various issues that are before us today. So people are getting activated. Certainly, Trump has become a dividing line across the entire country, and people very strongly feel very strongly, and they are expressing their views on either side of many of these issues.
So it sounds like, Daryl, it might be kind of a hard thing to measure if we're talking about protests in which people take to the streets with their feet. Maybe this is not the most active time in American history, but if we talk about other ways of protesting, really, really hard to say.
Well, when you think about the civil rights movement, I mean, some of those rallies had hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets. So just a very large demonstration of public discontent, people expressing their views about the racial discrimination that they were seeing at that time. There have been protests this year in Washington, D.C., that number in the tens of thousands, but that kind of pales in comparison to what we saw historically from some of these other time periods. Now, I do think the numbers are going to grow, and unlike the civil rights movement, where oftentimes there was a single march, and so you know people from across the country could go there, what we're seeing today is people are organizing in each of their home states. So a few months ago, there was this No Kings protest, and virtually every state across the country had tens of thousands of people. So if you add it all together, that actually does constitute a big number. So there certainly is a lot of public anxiety about many things that are happening these days.
Mark Brewer, what do we understand about protests and their ability to actually change the minds of people in power? Are there examples you can think of where a president or the majority of senators or congresspeople had their minds changed by mass protests?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the quintessential example of people in power's minds being changed by protests is the civil rights movement that, you know, that Daryl just referenced. But the key to protests being able to do that is calling into play, you know, third party actors to try and put pressure on decision makers. You know, political protest is not always, but more often than not is a mechanism utilized by the weaker side in, you know, an issue, right? If you're on the more powerful side of an issue, in terms of the political distribution of clout, protest isn't really a tool that you go to, at least the first one in your toolbox. It's a tool that the weaker side uses. And in order for it to be effective, you have to be able to bring third party pressure to bear to try and force that changing of minds that you talked about in terms of people with power.
So when you talk about third party pressure, are you talking about donors to political campaigns? Who are you talking about?
Well, you know, it could be a whole host of third parties. You know, donors could certainly be one mechanism that you try to bring into play. Could be the media, could be both a conduit to try and change opinion, or it could be change opinion of media influencers themselves. And I think Daryl brings up a good point about how things have changed that we're now in a social media age. That's another mechanism that you can try and reach out to for various third parties. Could be other interest groups. It could be other political actors. Could be public opinion at large. The list of potential third-party targets is pretty extensive, but unless you're able to get at least some movement on some of those, it's unlikely that your protest is going to have the effect that you want it to have.
Okay. Well, you know, I think Daryl mentioned just a couple minutes ago the No Kings protests that were in June, and I want to go back to those for just a minute. Right after those happened, NPR's Juana Summers did an interview with U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. Lisa Murkowski had not yet announced how she would vote on President Trump's sweeping budget bill. And she was not even asked about protests, but she was asked what people could do and had a very interesting answer. Here's part of it.
Don't assume that anybody else is going to speak up for you. Don't assume that, or don't give up. Don't be ground down because you don't think that you're being heard. It's when you stop speaking up that those of us who are in a position to listen start to think that, well, maybe your silence means you think everything is okay. And if you don't think it's okay, it's your obligation to speak up. I've never been to a protest as a protester, right? What we saw weekend before last with marches around the country, where people were speaking up in some of the smallest villages in Alaska. We had people that were speaking out, and maybe they were just speaking out to their neighbors. But I think that that's some of the best part of who we are, where we're in a country where you feel like you can speak up. Do it peaceably. Do it without violence. But speak up.
All right, I want to turn to you, Daryl. When you hear that, I think that piece of sound and that interview with Lisa Murkowski is really interesting on a lot of levels, but it sounds to me, Daryl, like she is talking about her own experience seeing these protests on television and that they did impact her thinking.
I think that's right. And the point that stands out for me in what she said is just the importance of people speaking out. And if enough people do that, legislators do start paying attention. And the senator has voted against several Trump initiatives and several proposed nominees to the various agencies. So clearly, at least at some level, the protests got her attention and perhaps even affected how she voted on the key issues. When I think historically about other successful movements like the Tea Party comes to mind, 2008, 2009, in the middle of the financial collapse, people were very upset about that. They organized. They had big gains in the 2010 midterm elections. So protests can be very successful. After all, our country was founded on protests of movements, the Tea Party from the revolutionary time period. So people do need to speak up. Legislators do pay attention if a number of people do that. And of course, the senator was emphasizing the importance of not engaging in violence. Violent protests tend not to be very effective, but peaceful protests from large numbers of people actually can be very successful.
Okay. And Mark, I'll turn to you because one of the things that's sort of ironic about this, one might say, and it might feed the cynicism of somebody, is that Lisa Murkowski in the end did end up voting for the very bill that these protesters were protesting against.
Right. I mean, and, you know, just it's not enough to for protesters to get their messages out there and to have other outlets or other groups pick them up and amplify them. Ultimately, a successful protest is going to force a decision maker, whether it be a member of Congress or a member of the executive branch or, you know, whatever your target is. It's going to force them to make a calculation that says that it's in their own best interest as a decision maker to side with the protesters over their opposition. And for elected office holders, that's often a difficult calculation that they have to engage in. So, you know, just because Lisa Murkowski seemingly says that she's affected by these protests, at the end of the day, for whatever reason, her individual calculation in this particular instance was to vote with the administration, not with the message that she was, you know, kind of referring to from the protesters. But it's a difficult decision for sure.
And Daryl, does that mean that these didn't work?
They weren't successful in stopping the legislation, but I think they were successful in being the first wave of public discontent about the Trump administration. There was a lot of media coverage at the time. And I think Mark is right in an important area, which is protest by itself is not going to be effective, but the goal is to basically enlist other people who might become sympathetic to your cause. And that could be people from the business community or donors or religious leaders. We often have seen religious leaders play a prominent role in various protest movements in the past. So even though that protest in June, No King's Day, was not successful in blocking Trump's budget bill, we've actually seen a lot of agitation since then. My expectation is in a couple of weeks, there's going to be the second wave of No King's protests. I think it's October 18th that is coming up. I think the numbers there are probably going to be even bigger because there is a backlash that has been building against various Trump initiatives. And so you have to see protest as a long-term strategy. You can't just march one day and think you're going to change the political system. It takes a consistent and continued effort over time. The protest needs to join other people who are more powerful than the protesters themselves. It's about coalition building. It's about having clear strategic goals. It's about contesting the election process and then ultimately trying to influence public policy.
All right. And I think both of you have mentioned the Boston Tea Party and sort of that being the original American protest that made a pretty big difference. But Mark, I want to ask you, is that a protest or is that an act of civil disobedience? And what's the line?
Well, I think the line's very, very blurry. In some cases, there might not even be a line there, right, between protest and civil disobedience. The line, where the line is, might depend on who you're asking and what their perspective is. But I would, you know, see the original Boston Tea Party as a protest. And I think the reason why it ended up being an effective protest is for one of the reasons that Daryl just referenced, it was able to influence and put pressure on and ultimately bring in some other political actors at the time who were maybe more powerful than those people engaging in the protests, right? I mean, what was going on there was you had some British colonists in North America who were very much in favor of independence and revolution against the Brits. But there were some other, maybe more powerful colonists who were somewhat on the fence and were reluctant and were concerned about taking such a step. As the pressure increased from various protest movements, was able to shift the opinion of some of these more powerful political actors in the British colonies and push them in the direction of independence and revolution. And so it's in that way, it's a quintessential recipe for what can make a protest movement successful. And the other thing I'd just like to tack on there is Daryl's absolutely right. Protest is a long game. Anybody who thinks that protest is going to be short and impactful, I guess theoretically it could happen, but the record doesn't really support that. Protest is a longer term game.
Daryl, I want to ask you, speaking of a longer term game, 5 years ago, we were talking about the Black Lives Matter protests. Have those been successful? Where are we in that long game?
They achieved some success in the short run in the sense of heightening public sentiment about police brutality. There was the officer involved actually ended up being convicted in that case. But of course, what protesters have to understand is protests sometimes generate counter-protests. There can be a backlash against whatever side you're arguing on an issue. As Mark points out, you know, it's a continuing process of protest and counter-protest, and whichever side turns out to be stronger can triumph in the end. And in the case of Black Lives Matter, like in the first year, they seem like they were being very successful, but then there was this backlash that Trump, of course, helped to orchestrate against that, and now we're actually seeing rollbacks, not just in the Black Lives Matters gains, but civil rights in general, racial equity, you know, all these diversity programs have been dismantled. So you'd have to say on a long-term basis, that protest ended up not being very successful because it was eclipsed by an even bigger protest organized by Donald Trump.
All right. And Mark, anything you want to add to thinking about now that we're 5 years out, the Black Lives Matter protests which were really, really huge.
Yeah, they were huge protests that took place obviously around the country. And I think as you know, Daryl pointed out, during that first year and a half, I think most people would have said, you know, that that protest movement and that collection of efforts was well on its way to being successful. And now if you look at it in the present, it's hard to say, you know, if much of anything was accomplished there. Now, that doesn't mean that narrative still couldn't change, right? But at the moment, that really seems to me like a striking example of a movement that looked like it was going to have a real powerful impact and some success. And it didn't turn out to be the case, at least not thus far. So I think that's important for us to all keep in mind when we're trying to gauge success or lack thereof, that it can take some time for it to all settle out.
And that's what I was going to ask you, Daryl. What is the lesson learned if you are an advocate and you are thinking both short-term and long-term about whatever it is you care about? What lesson do you take from where we are 5 years after the Black Lives Matter protests?
Well, I think the primary lesson is you have to think both short-term and long-term. Black Lives Matter won the short-term game, but seems now to be losing the longer-term game. So being persistent, you have to stick with it. You have to have a clear political strategy. You have to have a clear sense of what it is you want to achieve. Like when you look at protests that ended up failing, I would cite like Occupy Wall Street, you know, discontent against big Wall Street firms. they never really had a clear strategic vision of what they wanted to do. Like, they were upset with these Wall Street firms and felt that they contributed to the financial collapse of 2008 and 2009, but they were not able to capitalize on that, present a clear vision. So any advocate who wants to organize has to think long-term, has to have a clear vision, and has to anticipate that there will be people on the other side who counter-protest, and you have to expect that, and you have to have a strategy to deal with the inevitable counter-protests that are going to develop.
Well, we're talking about protests and civil disobedience and what kind of impact they have, both in modern times and in U.S. history. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Hey, Yo-Yo, why did you go to Acadia?
I wanted to welcome the sun.
Good morning, everybody.
I'm Ana Gonzalez, and I've been traveling around the country with Yo-Yo Ma for the past few years, meeting new people and playing music.
Powwow music is so different from Western classical music.
But in Maine, Yo-Yo just joined in.
I'm a human being first, a musician second, and a cellist third.
Listen to Our Common Nature from WNYC, where we use music to connect to nature, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're exploring the question of whether or not protests work anymore and how to define what that means. Joining me, UMaine political science professor Mark Brewer and senior fellow with the Brookings Institution, Daryl West. He is the Douglas Dillon Chair of Governmental Studies. Calling in now is Jen Lancaster, who is communications director for the League of Women Voters of Maine. Thanks so much for calling in, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
I understand the League of Women Voters came about in the years either during or after the suffragette movement. Tell me about your origins and its connection to protest.
Sure, that's an excellent question. You know, the women's suffrage movement was one of the longest running civil rights movements in this country. It launched in 1848 in Seneca Falls, and it would take 72 years to cross the finish line, and yet it would only guarantee white women the right to vote. So I want to talk about the early 1910s, and if we were to go back in time to maybe the year 1917, walk up to a Maine suffragette and ask if they thought protesting, or picketing as they would refer to it, was helping the cause, they would likely say no. And this is because by 1917, several Western states had expanded the vote, but the hope was that Maine would become the first state this side of the Mississippi to expand suffrage. Maine could change the tide. And even then, they'd use the phrase, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. If Maine expanded the vote, then surely the rest of the Eastern states would follow. And this referendum campaign was intense. It was conspicuous. These women mobilized to receive endorsements from political figures, such as Teddy Roosevelt. They received endorsements from the newspapers. And yet this effort failed 2-1. And one of the reasons of several that they gave for this defeat was due to those militant suffragettes who had been picketing or protesting at the White House. You know, picketing during that time was considered unwomanly behavior. To picket was to violate a social norm. It was radical. When suffragettes picketed outside of the White House, it stirred up a lot of anger and controversy among women and men. And it was happening despite this world war that was taking hold of the nation, because remember, this is 1917. But the women who protested, they were demanding, how can we be a democracy and yet deny women the right to vote? And this disagreement on whether or not it was appropriate to picket marked a deep schism in the women's suffrage movement.
That's really interesting, Jen. And I want to turn to one of our guests here, Daryl West, when you talk about that. And Daryl, you know, I think throughout history, there have been examples of when protesters are seen as being unseemly or objectionable. And can you talk about it? You know, Jen's talking about women and suffragettes, but how that influences public perceptions and decision makers.
Well, I thought Jen made a number of important points, and just the fact that it took 72 years to achieve the success of actually gaining the right to vote is illuminating, and it just shows protest is just part of a longer-term strategy, and sometimes it can take a long time before a group actually becomes successful. But I think you're right that we also have to understand protest is a political activity, And so opponents always are going to look at the most extreme elements of that protest and try and use that to characterize the whole movement. I mean, I recall, in the 1960s and 1970s, as part of the women's liberation movement, there were some women who basically burned their bras. And conservatives basically pointed to that and said, oh, they're these crazy women doing crazy things as a way to try and discredit the movement. And so I think in every protest movement, they have to think about what their mainstream is doing, but also what some of the more extreme elements might be doing, because the opponents are always going to pick on the extreme elements and try and use that to say they're all like that, and then use that as a way to discredit the whole movement.
Jen, I want to turn back to you. We've talked about historical protests and the suffrage movement, but I'm thinking about today, and I know that many times we've had members of the League of Women Voters on Maine Calling to talk about voting and voting rights. Does the League of Women Voters also as strongly support and promote our right to protest?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think in the aftermath of finally ratifying the 19th Amendment and finding success after all of these decades, and also the early 20th century, the Supreme Court started to redefine our First Amendment rights according to the Constitution. So we're finally kind of recognizing what a modern day protest looks like. And so in 1920, when the League of Women Voters was formed, mostly to encourage women to participate in politics and to become more informed, they also finally understood that actually protesting, coupled with intense advocacy work, organizing, can lead to successful movements. And to this day, we strongly promote the right to protest. We know that this is a constitutional right that should be protected.
Well, Jen, thanks so much for calling in. Jen Glancaster with the League of Women Voters in Maine. We will go to John now, calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi there. The subject of protest. In my life, I've definitely seen it work over and over again. Early on, it was obvious that protests shortened the Vietnam War. I later saw protests of an oil supertanker in Puget Sound that was covered quite a lot lead to a ban, a denial of permit for the Northern Tier pipeline, and a restriction on supertankers in Puget Sound. Protests worldwide led to bans on nuclear waste dumping at sea, which is still in effect, and a ban on commercial whaling, which is still in effect. And as to whether or not they're getting smaller or larger, I think the Women's March of 2017 was one of the largest protests, if not the largest protest ever. And
yeah, well,
protests on the right often work. No doubt that protests on the right are keeping firearms in America largely unregulated, despite pressure on the other side. So, it's a two-way thing. And a lot of it depends upon whether people do it right, and it should always be nonviolent.
Yeah, John, I really thank you so much for the examples you gave. And Mark, one thing that strikes me about some of John's examples are, you know, we've been talking about up until this point, big national protests, not local and regional protests, but also big protests about things that are already in the news. But Mark, also they can play the role of magnifying, amplifying something that's quietly happening, and that, and I'm thinking that maybe that's a little bit different purpose than some of the other protests we've been discussing.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the scholars that I always refer back to when we're thinking about things like protest movement is the work of E. Schatzneider, and Schatzneider, you know, wrote about these kind of things in his work, The Semi-Sovereign People. He's like, those who are in power would like to be able to go about their business kind of behind closed doors and do so quietly, right? And for people who disagree with maybe what's being done, but are on the weaker side of the political argument, at least at that point, one of the things that they can do is try and bring attention to what's going on and try and shed the light on that and get more people paying attention to it through media coverage, through demonstrations, which can often start out very small, even grassroots level. And if they're successful in getting more people involved, getting more eyeballs or people hearing things, it can grow from there. And I think you're absolutely right in that, you know, a protest doesn't have to be big and national or international in order to be effective. In fact, many of the most successful protests often start, you know, kind of small and more local, and then if they build momentum and grow.
John, thanks so much for your call. Daryl, you were mentioning social media and some of the other ways that we engage in protest today. One thing I don't think we've discussed yet is boycott. And I'm just wondering if you can talk, Daryl, about the power of the boycott in protest, whether you're talking about a boycott of, and probably mostly of a product or a company.
Boycotts do have a long history, and a number of them actually have been successful. Probably the most recent one that achieved some success was when Elon Musk was leading the Doge budget cutting efforts within the Trump administration. There were people who organized against Tesla, you know, one of his major companies, and they had rallies in front of his auto dealerships and kind of railed against the company. And we all saw what happened. It's like the company stock dropped, sales in the United States and Europe dropped, even when the electric vehicle market in general was growing. So that was clearly a boycott effort that was very successful. And I think in the social media world, there are a lot of things that can go viral very quickly. And so the one thing that is different about the current time period is it can actually accelerate the impact and the success of protests, because, you know, before digital technology, it might take weeks, months, or years to organize particular communities. Now, because of online rage, you can actually organize people pretty quickly if there's some flashpoint that gets them very upset. The only cautionary tale I would make about social media is some people think if they've tweeted their outrage against something, they have engaged in protest. It's not the same thing. I tell people, like, if you want to be a successful protester, you know, it's okay to use social media to express your outrage about some issue, but you then have to follow it up with actual efforts, organizing, building coalitions, contesting elections, trying to be successful in a broader political context.
We're going to go to Kitsy calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy, go ahead.
Hi, I've been arrested three times in my life. I'm now in my 87th year, and I'm protesting, but I can't do it the way I did in 1977, where I, along with 1,200 other people, protested nuclear power at that point. And I was ignorant about it. I thought, oh, goody, you know, after we dropped the bombs on Hiroshima, now we have a peaceful atom. Little did I know that the utilities had fought that tooth and nail. And what the government wanted the utilities to do it is they needed the plutonium. Well, I didn't know that until I decided I would join the Clamshell Alliance. And so we marched on the Seabrook construction plant. One plant was underway, Seabrook, New Hampshire, right on the coast, and 1,200 of us got arrested. And we were incarcerated. They had to open five armories in New Hampshire because 1,200 of us were would not give up, and we were put on buses and taken to the armories, and we stayed for 1 week incarcerated, and it took 2 years for them finally to drop the charges because they just couldn't seem to go anywhere with it. But what I learned in there and in that week was just unbelievable.
Well, Kitsy, and it sounds like we have so many callers. I'm going to speed you up a little bit,
yeah.
But it sounds as though what you're saying is that second reactor was never built, and you believe that
right.
You all had an impact, right?
Yes, and it slowed down the building, building halted right then. And about 10 years later, somebody reflected back and said that was the most significant thing when 1,200 people got incarcerated for a week. And it really, obviously it didn't stop it, but it slowed it down. And it let me know how not only important it is, but how much we learn when we protest with other people who know more about the issue than we do.
All right. Well, Kitsy, thank you so much for calling in. I want to go to an email here from Peter. Just today, there was a story about government using drones in Los Angeles to monitor and surveil protesters. How is evolving technology curtailing our First Amendment rights? How can citizens fight back? Daryl West, what are the rights of protesters, and what are you seeing today, whether it's drones or other methods that may be different?
I mean, I think that's a great question and comment from Peter, in the sense digital technology, I think, is changing the nature of citizen protests, but it's changing it in both positive and negative ways. So he points out what he would view, I would imagine, as a negative use of technology, of government agencies using drones to monitor protests. And, you know, you can drones often have video cameras on them. With the use of facial recognition software, if you have the photographic image of a protest movement, you can then use facial recognition software to identify individuals and then either establish databases or go after them in one form or another. But we should also keep in mind there's some ways in which digital technology now is empowering ordinary people and giving them new tools. For example, everybody today is a journalist, in the sense we have cell phones with photographic capabilities as well as video capabilities. And I know just from my experience over the last couple of months in Washington, D.C., where there have been a lot of protests against the ICE-led immigration raids that have taken place in the capital city, you know, whenever these raids take place, people talk about it online, they rush out to the street, they start recording the arrests. And what they're looking for is some violent incident that can galvanize people who are opposed to these immigration raids. Because sometimes, you know, the old saying, a picture is worth a thousand words. Well, a video may be worth a million words. You know, if it really captures, like, the police being overly violent in the way they're doing things, the image of masked men in unmarked cars coming up and grabbing somebody off the street, like, those pictures really can make a difference. So the drone technology combined with facial recognition might be a negative way it's impacting protest politics. But then the video aspect, in fact, that anybody can record these videos, actually, I think, empowers a lot of people in ways that previously would not have been the case.
All right. Well, we do need to take another quick break talking about the power of protests on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the power of protests and demonstrations and civil disobedience. Our guest today, Daryl West, governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and Mark Weber with the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine. We'll go up to Holton in Maryland. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hi. My first comment is because I'm 90 and have been on the streets for about 70 years, is whether you need to be out there because you think you are effective or you are out there because you are true to your values. And I think some of us realize that being true to our values and supporting things and protesting things is important. We have had we have a group here called Restore, and we have had six rallies since January. We had 200 out for the first No Kings, and we're working now on the No Kings number two, which will be October the 18th, and we're already one of the 1,300 places in the United States on the map there that will be protesting.
Marilyn, it sounds to me as though your philosophy is not whether or not to think of a protest as effective, but whether to think of what your responsibility as a citizen is, and that this is what we all ought to be doing, is standing up for our values.
That's correct. And we usually have, with our protests, we have letters to the editor. And, of course, we also believe in calling our congresspeople and the White House. And so it's sort of a three-pronged support. We have with Canada, because we're right on the border here in Holton with Canada, all across the U.S. side of the U.S.-Canadian border on July the 5th, there were supports for Canada. One of our big signs says, pleased to be your neighbor. We sang there were flags.
So protest as a different purpose there to show solidarity and support. Marilyn, I thank you so much for calling in. And Mark, listening to Marilyn makes me think of what Lisa Murkowski said, which is, if you do not protest, we, and she meant U.S. senators, will think that you are agreeing with what is happening.
I think that's right. I mean, one of the things that elected officials really pay a huge amount of attention to is to what their constituents are thinking about, talking about, and how they feel on important issues. And the technology that allows them to try and track that has changed, obviously, dramatically over time. But one thing that has remained consistent is that elected officials, their number one motivation is to get reelected. And to do that, they have to maintain the support of at least a plurality of their constituents. So obviously, they're going to care a great deal about what their constituents think on important issues of the day. So there is no doubt that registering one's opinion, is not only can be terribly effective, but, could be seen as a important part of being a responsible, effective citizen.
We'll go to David calling from Bucksport. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you. I am so proud to be on this program with other activists around the state that are calling in. 265 weeks ago, on August 31st of 2020, we had our first Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bucksport. We quickly turned it into, I say, we stand for everything that's woke, because who wants to sleep through life? So this coming Saturday will be our 265th consecutive weekly demonstration on the little bridge between Bucksport and Verona Island. My history goes back 45 years when I was in ACT UP in Kansas City, fighting on the streets with civil disobedience and great protesting that has molded my life, and the trajectory is going to go on until I die. Being on the
yeah.
street with
David, thank you so much for calling in. And yeah, I appreciate it, because Daryl, here in Maine, and I'm sure throughout the country, there are places where there is a group of protesters who show up at the same place on the same day, either every week or every month. And I'm wondering about the impact of that. You know, we've been talking a lot about these great big protests where everybody goes to the mall in Washington or goes to the state capitol. But what about those folks that you see, like David said, weekly on that bridge?
I think local events can be very powerful, and I applaud David and the other activists who are involved. I've spent my entire life trying to encourage people to participate, to stay engaged in politics, because as we've seen clearly for many years now, politics matters. The budget bills matter, the policy actions, the executive orders that are coming out of the White House matter a lot. So people do need to be engaged, and it's a cumulative thing that sometimes the power of a protest emerges from the long-term effort, the intensity that is associated with that, and the fact that people see this as part of a broader process that they're trying to influence.
David, thanks for calling in. We will go now to Lisbon and Scott. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I, like so many of the people on this call, in my 80th year, I was in the Army during Vietnam, and when I got out of the Army, I sort of protested. I didn't really. I complained about it. I said it was wrong. I wrote about it. But what I've experienced in latter years have really created a lot of energy in me, enough so that I've literally run for office, and then I have protested. and got involved with the Maine People's Alliance, and have literally gone to Washington, D.C., and gotten arrested in the Dirksen office building for civil disobedience. I don't do it because I think it will make all the difference in the world. I do it because I don't have a choice. I have to do it. There doesn't seem to be any alternative.
And Scott,
I fought for.
Yeah, you sound like Marilyn. That you know, that this is what you feel as though your obligation is today. And I so appreciate you calling in and telling your story. Daryl, thoughts on Scott's story and his reasons today for being involved?
Well, I appreciate his dedication and the fact that he's out there trying to do it. I guess the advice I would give to activists is to try and link their activities with other groups, because it's all about building the coalition, broadening the base, getting more people involved, kind of maintaining it over time. Like when you look historically at protest movements that have been successful versus those that have been far less successful, it's like kind of building that coalition is really the key aspect. So to the extent that people can connect with other groups and broaden the base, I think that is a critical ingredient in long-term success.
All right. Well, I appreciate it very much, Scott. Let's see here. We're so tight on time and so many people calling in and emailing in. But I want to, a couple people are worried about today, this moment today, and violence, and whether they will be targeted with violence because they're taking part in protests, or protests themselves turning violent. And Daryl, I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, that is a legitimate concern, given the president's statements and the statements that have come out of his administration. Because, you know, it's interesting, like when I was growing up, if you kind of think about violence, you would think of a physical action targeted against a government official, law enforcement, or whatever, you know, pushing a police officer, punching the person or whatever. But the Trump administration now is broadening the definition of violence to include organizations that encourage, facilitate, foment, or fund violence, meaning you don't actually have to do violence yourself to be accused of being an accessory to violence. So protesters do have to be more careful. They have to understand that the crime of violence has been broadened in ways that go beyond the physical act themselves. So it's a legitimate concern about the targeting aspect. But you know, people, that should not dissuade people from expressing their views. Obviously, there are many callers to the show who feel very intensely about the issues, and I certainly encourage them to stay involved in whatever the cause is that they're concerned about.
And here is an email from Carol. Can the guest speak to the rights of protesters? When is it legitimate for law enforcement to break up a protest? Mark Brewer, do you know the answer?
Well, I think the answer depends on a variety of things. I mean, one of the things that a lot of localities will use, and if they want to crack down on a protest, is have the protesters gotten the proper permits, right? There's usually a permitting process, and if you have the proper permits, then that means you're allowed to at least get to the start line. But if you don't have it, it can be a venue for shutting it down. If you're going to take the larger constitutional picture, I mean, the current, you know, Supreme Court status for, you know, shutting a protest down would be the imminent lawless action test, right? Which is, will the actions of the protesters result directly in lawless action? And if that's the case, then the protest can be shut down. Obviously, it's not always that black and white, right? And anytime you've got human beings involved, there's a certain amount of judgment there. And one of the things I always tell my students is, that your civil liberty protections are never as clear-cut as the words on a piece of paper might make them seem.
And let me follow up by asking you, Mark, are the rights of protesters different if that protester is a U.S. citizen versus if that protester is not?
Well, certainly, I think that is true. And there's been a number of court cases over the years looking at what parts of the Bill of Rights and other elements of civil liberties protection in the United States apply to citizens versus non-citizens. I think the stakes right now are obviously much higher there than they've been at various times in the past. And it adds another level of concern to possibly going out and engaging in protest for someone who's a citizen versus someone who's not.
Well, I'm going to apologize right now to all those who sent in questions and we weren't able to get to them because we are out of time. Thank you both for joining us today. Mark Brewer, a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, and Daryl West, senior fellow and chair of governmental studies at the Brookings Institution. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.